retread.
We'll call the House Committee on Sustainability and Economic Development to order. Today is the 29th of January. Appreciate you being here. We'll continue our exploration of sort of the baseline of things that are happening in the state as we get ready to consider bills. We have an interesting panel today, I think, on manufacturing and things that are happening there to help Oregon businesses become more competitive, expand and excel, and to talk about some of those benefits in terms of the efficiency and sustainability aspects. So if everybody's ready, we'll go ahead and get started by inviting Pat Murphy up from the Oregon Manufacturing Extension Partnership. And happy to hear from you. Thanks for coming.
Thank you, Chair Reed. Hey, members. My intent was to give you a very brief overview of the Manufacturing Extension Partnership, the work we do, and how it ties into the sustainability and economic development issues. As soon as I'm done, I want to introduce our speakers. We just had a change. Peter Murray from Welch Allen in Beaverton was supposed to be here. We will have him by phone. He is going through an FDA audit and certification to make medical equipment. Last-minute thing, the auditors couldn't let him go. He has to sign a document before that they can leave. So his apologies, but we will have him by phone. The Manufacturing Extension Partnership has been around 20 years now. It was started by the Department of Commerce and is administered by the National Institute of Standards and Technology. There's an MEP in every state. There are actually 59 MEP centers and one in Puerto Rico. The mission of the MEP is to help small and medium-sized manufacturers be more competitive in a global marketplace. The MEP provides a great number of services, but really the primary means of carrying out the mission is to help companies implement lean manufacturing. Lean, by definition, is usually described as a systematic approach to eliminating waste or non-value-added activity. You'll hear short ones, too, like faster, better, cheaper. Ours is based on a Toyota production system. It's really evident all over the world, and it's gone well beyond manufacturing. The focus of this eliminating waste has traditionally been on the manufacturing waste, like building too much, taking things too far distances, storing too long a distance, or too large a place. And in the packet I gave you, you'll see a one-page document that lists on one side the traditional manufacturing waste, and on the other side, environmental waste. And it's been recognized by many folks, including us in the last couple of years, that many of the activities that are done in a lean activity or lean implementation impact the environmental side of the operations, such as energy use, water use, solid waste. We just didn't really take credit for it or focus on it, and that's what we started to do, and that's really the connection here. You're going to hear from one of our clients who is just going through a pilot with us. The Green Supplier Network with the Environmental Protection Agency and the Energy Trust and PGE. So a definite connection with the two there. The funding model, I have to mention, for the Oregon MEP or all MEPs is based on a model of funding from three sources. And the model is a third from the federal, a third from the state, and a third from the fees we charge for services. What that really means is a 2-to-1 match is required to bring down the federal dollars. We, up until the last, I think, three and a half years ago, were leaving federal money on the table, and then we were lucky enough to expand through grants from other sources, and we haven't done that. However, the funding we do get from the state comes through Oregon Economic and Community Development Department, and it's never approached the one-third level, and in fact was cut last biennium. So we rely heavily on fees, our consulting fees. Our projects are frequently 6 months to 2 to 3 years with clients, and many of them are actually subsidized, some by Workforce Investment Act money, other local grants, because some of these clients would never afford us or could afford us if they weren't subsidized in some way. In the packet, I also you'll see a map that shows clients we've worked with around the state for about the past 24 months. We do everything we can to cover the entire state. We've got one fellow who makes regular trips back and forth to Baker City and has for quite some time. We have a person in Eugene, and we have one in Medford who actually went with one of our clients, a startup company, and decided to stay with them. So he's still doing contract work for us, but we have some level of coverage there. There's a brochure that talks a little bit about us. There's a page of results you'll see that maybe I'll have an opportunity to discuss later. We report all our quantifiable results to the federal government, to OECD. All those results come from an independent survey that's conducted by a national company. 12 months after a period of project is completed, they're moving that to now 6 months afterward. You'll see the focus on jobs. And then the last piece, I believe, is a story about Welch Allyn that you'll see, or rather hear, updated by Pete Murray, who I hope is on the phone. And I thought I'd rather just introduce the speakers. If you have questions, obviously be glad to answer them. But I think you'll hear more detail about what we do and the connections listening to them.
Are there any general questions before we hear from the speakers and the stories? Seems like that makes sense to go ahead then. Do we want to get Mr. Murray on the phone first, or have the person who's here? I'm seeing nods, so let's go ahead and do that.
Hello? Mr. Murray?
Maybe you just can't hear us.
Mr. Murray? Perhaps we better move on and come back to this. We're having some difficulty on the telephones for the moment, so maybe we can switch the order a little bit, if that's okay.
Then let's ask Mark Givadon.
That'd be great.
Or Mark Shepherd from Givadon, excuse me.
Sometimes we get associated with the names of our...
I will groups. Go and call on another phone to see if there's a problem there.
That'd be great. Very good. Please come forward.
Take that. I'll call.
Okay.
Thanks for coming. And as you get started, if you wouldn't mind identifying yourself for the record, that would help us.
Thank you. My name is Mark Shepherd. I'm operations manager at Givadon Silverton. I've never attended one of these before, so a little nervous, if you'll forgive me.
You're doing fine.
Maybe the best way to start would be to give you a little history about who we are and what we do. I have a handout. It has a Givadon letterhead on it. And rather than read it, maybe I can just kind of fill in the blanks. We are a manufacturer of food flavors and ingredients and located, as I said, in Silverton. We manufacture flavors and ingredients that go into many of the foods that you see and buy in the grocery store and in restaurants. Currently, we have 45 full-time employees. We operate year-round, three shifts, 5 days a week. And during the harvest season, in the fall, we operate on a 24-hour, 7-day schedule. Most of the raw materials that we utilize in our process come from right here in the Willamette Valley. Probably 80% of the vegetable and fruit raw materials that we use come locally. Also, we contract with local growers in the Marion County area to supply us with sweet corn during the fall harvest season, and we manufacture a sweet corn products that, as the outline shows, are sold around the world. One of the unique aspects of sweet corn is that many countries, populations and countries around the world really like sweet corn soup. And we're happy to be able to make the primary ingredient that goes into sweet corn soup. Givaudan and Silverton is a jointly owned company, jointly owned by a family, Oregon family, and Givaudan SA, which is a Swiss-owned company. We're the only natural or fruit and vegetable manufacturer in the organization. Our connection to Lean and to OMEP dates back to 2005, when we were awarded a grant to explore lean manufacturing processes within the food industry. Previously, if you know a little bit about the lean process, it was relegated to the hard industries, automobiles, refrigerators, things like that. And so food processing was kind of out of the ordinary. And so during that process, we were able to do several things through the project. One, because 50% of our employees are Hispanic, part of that lean training was to actually teach our Hispanic employees to understand English related to their job functions. Also, one of the benefits that came out of it was we changed from a typical push-type organization wherein you fill floor stocks into your warehouse and wait for customer orders, and went to a pull lean process, which means the customer orders, we manufacture the product and ship. It resulted in significant savings to us and completely changed our operation. Now we're a, call it just-in-time manufacturer. We're a manufacturer on order, and we have saved hundreds of thousands of dollars in that process. So we've become a real kind of a proponent and disciple of the lean process, if you will. To get back to where we are today and with this committee, most recently, the word sustainability has become a real hot topic. Green, carbon footprint, of course. Because we are a worldwide exporter of goods, food ingredients, many of the large customers, and especially in Europe, have put certain requirements on us to provide sustainability and other green-related facts to them. In other words, tell us about the products that you make from field through manufacture and how it affects the carbon footprint and sustainable measures. So we were approached by the Oregon Energy Trust and by OMEP to participate in a lean energy process. And again, this is using lean manufacturing processes and planning to actually take a look at the energy usage within a company and to look at the entire energy usage. That includes everything from water, sewer, natural gas, electricity, hydraulics, all of the many different energy uses that a manufacturing or processing facility uses, and to look at those in ways that utilizing a term called value stream mapping actually gets you to completely understand all of the energy uses and the costs of those energy uses within the company and the facility. The outcome of that process is to understand in actual cost per pound how much it costs you to use natural gas, electricity, water, and then through the Oregon Energy Trust and PGE, you actually identify projects that will in turn save money by, for instance, installing more efficient motors, maybe changing the lighting, being able to resolve wasted energy, essentially. And so that's the purpose of this pilot project. We just recently finished the initial auditing process, and we'll now be engaging some electrical engineers from PGE to take a closer look at what we have identified as potential savings, and then be able to apply those within our operation. The additional benefit, I guess, with this, especially this pilot program, is we became aware, and when I say we, I'm talking about our plant engineer, our controller, myself, and some of the other folks in the operation. We recognize that we really don't know that much about the energy use in our plant. Yes, we get a natural gas bill. Yes, we get an electric bill. We've got motors. We've got boilers. We need all of these to function and to produce the products that we make. But have we really looked at it to explore how we can cut back on that energy usage or use it in a different way to save us money and to expel less carbon dioxide into the atmosphere? This process has really opened our eyes. So other than saying that our eyes are really opened and we're a real proponent of this process, that's what I have to offer. Any questions?
I hope we do have some questions. I just want to say I really appreciate you you coming. You did great as your first time, and it really helps us when we hear the stories of how these initiatives can make real impacts in the business world. So, with that, I'll ask if there are any questions, Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In my district has Ontario in it. Ontario has an onion oil manufacturer in it, and I think they were purchased by a group in Holland. And I think they sell most of their onion oil to McCormick. And I'm just curious, you are affiliated with a company in where?
In Switzerland.
In Switzerland.
Yeah.
So how is are these concepts making their way to Switzerland, or how's that working?
Good question. Because we are the, in this organization, and we were acquired as a joint venture just a year and a half ago, we're more or less a standalone operation within the organization. And although we sell our products into the larger Givaudan organization, most of the management practices that we utilize at this point in time and the business practices are, I guess we're somewhat isolated from that standpoint. My goal, working with the larger organization, especially when we see the results of this energy audit, because Givaudan has more than 50 manufacturing operations around the globe, would be then to work toward helping the larger organization understand the benefits. At this time, it's solely relegated to us.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So a trip for you there is not in the immediate future, is that correct?
The North American headquarters is in Cincinnati, so that's more likely. We also have several North American manufacturing sites as well, so that is a possibility.
Thank you.
And is there a chance then that you might become the laboratory for the perhaps the North American, or maybe even someday the global Givaudan? Can you become the expert that is helping educate the rest of the organization?
My goal, yes, Mr. Chairman, my goal eventually would be to do just that. Back in 2005, when we were part of the company then, Quest International, Givaudan bought Quest International to become the largest flavor and fragrance manufacturer in the world. In 2005, I attended a global operations and supply chain summit in Mexico, and I took the value stream map. We had just most recently completed the project with OMEP, and I took my value stream map, which takes up most of a wall. You've probably seen, if you, you
I have.
Looks like you've seen them before.
I've seen those at Nike. They do take
yes.
some space.
So I took a PowerPoint presentation and my value stream map, had it sent, and actually put it up on the wall, and it was attended there by all of the manufacturing sites for Quest at that time. And that made quite a splash, and actually Quest did implement and begin lean process training with it, with all of their sites. A lot of that is lost, as you know, when companies are melded into a larger organization, things get consolidated, and so we've lost some of that traction. But my goal is to reinstill it.
Glad to hear it. Representative Holby, did I see you indicating an interest in the motion?
Not much. I'm just listening.
Okay. Thank you. I thought I saw you raise your hand a little bit earlier. Are there other questions? If not, I have a couple. How did the fees that OMEP charges impact your decision? If it was, are there more things you'd like to be doing?
Good question. We have been fortunate, I'll be honest, to have been able to participate in several grants such that the fees have been minimal. We provide, I think, as was explained earlier, part of the fee structure is matching. We provide matching costs with obviously salaries and wages for the people that are involved in the training, any of the costs that we incur to make the improvements necessary as a result of the lean studies. So while those costs have been minimal, we recognize the extreme savings that have benefited us, and I think that there is much more willingness to actually to be willing to pay some fees. But in the food processing world, there tend to be, especially for training of employees and for putting new processes in place that especially utilize raw materials and natural ingredients, things locally, there's good opportunity to access funds through grants that way. But I guess in response to your question, would we be willing to pay fees knowing the outcomes? Yes.
Glad to hear it. And have you found, you mentioned to a certain extent some of the answer to this question, but I can see a lot of benefit as you eliminate costs and increase your efficiency and so on, just in terms of a competitive advantage. But have you found that sustainability factor has been a competitive advantage beyond the cost savings as you're out in the world?
Sustainability, because it's becoming such a it's becoming almost a buzzword out in the industry, and food processing in particular, it is seen as a real marketing tool and marketing advantage as well. We have a very large customer in Europe who actually has initiated a program called Muddy Boots, which is a process whereby you evaluate and analyze everything through the raw materials that you use, even the growers of those raw materials, right up through the way you use them within your facility, and you actually participate in an audit, and that gets posted and becomes a requirement of doing business with the company. So sustainability has much more economic benefit than just the cost savings to the company.
In some ways, it might be a way to differentiate yourself from a otherwise sort of commodity product.
Very, very much so. Anything you can do to add value, as you know, to products and give you that competitive advantage, it helps. And with the green and the carbon footprint going now, the fact that we utilize raw materials that are very close to our facility gives us some of that competitive advantage. We're not trucking products in from hundreds or thousands of miles away. Things come close, and so that's exactly what it would do.
Thank you. Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. Hey, I'm wondering, you were established back in 1977. OMEP was came into being, it sounds like, another 11, 12 years later. How did you find out about these programs that OMET has? Did they come to you? Did you read about them? Just wondering.
Thank you, Representative. We stay, because of the food processing industry is actually quite close to many of the economic development organizations in the state. And we were actually, when we initially moved to Silverton, it wasn't too long afterwards that we were approached by members of the Oregon Economic Development Department. Tom Fox, I believe, approached us and actually asked how they could be of service. And at that period of time, we were looking for ways, especially because our workforce is so Hispanic, most of the workers, and the language barrier is great. We asked for training. You know, we'd really like to find some training. They were then able to put us in touch with the OMEP people because at that time this lean manufacturing coming into the food industry had just started getting some traction. So I guess it's just communication by asking questions of the various state agencies that were able to help us.
Follow-up?
Well, sort of a follow-up. It's actually kind of a different question, but you mentioned your workforce. I'm wondering what types of positions do people hold there, the different classes? You don't have to give me a rundown each,
sure.
You know, okay,
sure,
we've got a secretary.
Fine.
We've got, and then what would you say the average pay would be for these folks?
Thank you for, you would call them semi-skilled positions, okay, the workers in the plant, operators and lead people that operate equipment and operate, we have a batch operation, so they mix raw materials together, perform the processes that make the end product. Of course, we have warehousing, we have research and development, QA. So the positions are from highly educated, highly skilled, all the way down to semi-skilled people that operate forklifts. Average wage rate in the plant is about $10 an hour for production workers. Up to $15-$18 for more skilled positions. But our goal is to provide family or livable incomes to the production workers. Another benefit of the lean process has helped us with the cost savings. We were actually able to pass that on in increased wages to the workers in the plant.
One more question. How's business? Are you affected by any of this turmoil happening right now?
People have to eat. It is a term that we hear a lot in our business. We all have to eat. 2007 was a record sales year for us, and 2008 beat 2007 by about 15%. So we're very fortunate. We're seeing growth in our business. We try to be innovative and stand out from everyone else. And as long as customers continue new projects and bring new products to the market, we're happy to be involved in that.
Are you publicly traded?
How does the that's an interesting answer as far as that you're growing. Does the growth come from new products? Are you taking share from others in the industry? Are you creating new things? What accounts for your growth and success?
Primarily, our growth comes from new products. We strive very hard to work with the large food manufacturers to develop the products that they want. So we are driven by their needs, and we're fortunate that we do have a good relationship. I'll plug one product. You don't have to take me up on it, but we helped one of the largest cereal manufacturers in the world develop a new product. It's called Blueberry Special K. So I didn't name the manufacturer, but I can name the product. Try it. It's wonderful, and it has Oregon blueberries in it. So,
thank you.
that is how we develop our business.
It's a good story about good things from Oregon going outside. Representative Holby.
I'm curious, and I apologize if you sort of addressed this to start with, but as far as, you know, in the terms of sustainability, I imagine that, you know, your processes have byproducts or waste products, and I'm wondering what kind of, or whether there's, you know, resources available to research or figure out what to do with those byproducts to create another value-added product for your business and deal with potentially a costly byproduct that you have to deal with. And do you have experience with that specifically?
Yes, thank you. That's actually a very good question, Representative. We manufacture, as I said, sweet corn powder products, and when you process sweet corn, you only recover one-third of the actual weight of a ear of corn. One-third is kernels, which we use. One-third is cob, and one-third is husk. So if you've got a pound of corn, you've got two-thirds of a pound of waste, essentially. We wanted not to send that to the landfill or to a compost pile, and actually a number of years ago contacted Tillamook County Creamery, and we now send all of our waste husk material and cob material, it's called silage, over to Tillamook County Creamery. And so when you eat Tillamook cheese, you're actually eating some of our corn from here in Silverton. Another way that we are able to recycle those byproducts is we purchase a tremendous amount of product in poly buckets, white plastic 5-gallon buckets, thousands and thousands of them. It's the nature of the raw material that comes in it. It has to be frozen quickly, and that's the most economical way to freeze it. There's a company here in Kaiser, although with the economy being what it is, things aren't quite as strong there, but they actually take those buckets from us, grind them up, and resell them into the recycle market. So we try very hard to either recycle or move all of the waste materials that we can back into the economy. We also use a tremendous amount of what are called cardboard totes. They're very large. They hold 1,000 to 1,500 pounds of fruit or vegetable product. Those also get recycled into the cardboard market. Unfortunately, a lot of that is just being stored now, as you know, there's not a strong market for it. But we continually look for ways to maintain that sustainability aspect of the company.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Please.
Well, in regards to that, I was just kind of curious how your business model structures, you know, the investing resources into trying to accomplish that, and I imagine that that's probably somewhat of a barrier, and I'm just kind of curious, you know, going at what point do you make a decision, well, we're going to invest in trying to figure out what to do with this, or, you know, I'm just wondering, you know, what it takes for a company like yours to say, we need to do an investment like this, and what are the barriers to you doing that other than, you know, it's just not cost effective?
Certainly. Again, we're customer driven, and many of our customers make doing business with us, they make a requirement that we show them or demonstrate ways that we are a sustainable business and have sustainable business practices. So that motivates us to look for those ways to do that. Additionally, we want to be a good neighbor. We're located in a industrial park in Silverton, and 50 feet from us is a large housing subdivision that was just built a couple of years ago. And so our goal, obviously, is to try to present a good, clean image, as well as, again, satisfying our customers' needs. So there's strong motivation, and typically the payback is very short in ways that you maintain business with a good customer, and you're also able to help other businesses in the community through getting your byproducts back into it.
There aren't other questions. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is just, you don't have to expand on the answer to this question much, but I just noticed, and maybe I should have asked this question to Mr. Murphy, but I just noticed that there wasn't anything on these lists that are designed to kind of streamline your business regarding government. And I was just curious, maybe this is your opportunity to tell us what you think we should do to help streamline your operation. Just pick one.
Thank you, Representative Benz. Good question.
Thank you, Representative. I can say that the regulatory side of our business is becoming more and more, and maybe the right word is not onerous, but it's very demanding. We have to satisfy so many regulations in certain areas that really don't have a lot to do with the products that we produce and the products that we produce. So I guess help from if there was a so-called some expert that could come in and look at the regulations and help advise us on things that we're doing that are a waste of time and money, or maybe there's a way that we can become exempt from that. And maybe I'm being a little facetious here, but seriously, the regulations, there are so varied in many of them that it takes all an organization like us, 45 employees, we have one person that's dedicated essentially solely to fulfilling regulatory requests and forms and those types of issues.
It just seemed to me, in looking at the outline here and the way you're walking through all the different areas that you deal with, government could almost fill another column. And I have heard remarks that suggest you almost have to bring someone in to try to help fight their way through it. So your recommendation to us then would be that we look into some of those regulations, or do you have a recommendation for us?
I would have to give that some thought, honestly. Government is part of our lives. We pay taxes and we meet deadlines. There's some helpful sides to us. The Oregon Department of Agriculture, ODA, has helped us many times. We became certified on a particular corn product that a customer requested. ODA helped us attain that certification. Obviously, we're audited by the ODA. Food plants need to be, and to make sure our products are safe and have an outside agency, that's helpful. If my controller were here, I think he'd have some great ideas from the finance side.
Feel free to keep in touch with us about those
ideas.
Thank
you. I will do that.
Right here. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for being here. I, too, thought you did a great job. I would have thought you were far more experienced at this type of thing. And I'm just pleased that this panel can see what great businesses we have in our district.
I was wondering when you were going to say something. Thanks, Representative Gilliam.
It's one of many.
Thank you.
But a really good one. But to Representative Benz's point, as diplomatic as you were about government's assistance, clearly the drive, with the exception of our program of OMED, the drive towards sustainability, as you said, is from customers, which would be from the private sector.
Correct.
And to a certain extent, you know, this is why my hat's off to our chair, is that we're trying to be part of that or to improve that. We don't, at least my purpose is not to add more to your burden, but to get on the bandwagon if we can and help you with sustainability, because I see very clearly you know, from a local standpoint, the good that you do in the community. So thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I wanted to follow up with Representative Bent's comments. And, you know, because it occurs to me that, you know, state government does have a role in helping business and industry wade through regulation, as you sort of referred to it in my mind. And, you know, we have some models, you know, we have the government streamlining initiative sometimes, and I think we still have an Office of Government Streamlining. Could be wrong. But we also, you know, look at different things. We've instituted e-permitting systems for the building industry, for example, to help out, and it seems like there might be a nexus there for other industries that they could accomplish a lot more or a lot faster accomplishment of regulations if there was some sort of connectivity between this regulation and all the different regulations you have to deal with in sort of an online fashion to, you know, help you get through those processes faster. I don't know if that exists in your particular industry at this point, but it might be an interesting thing to look at, I guess, to see what different agencies do you have to deal with, for example, and, you know, what is the paperwork involved in getting through all those processes, and do you have to do one before the other, and, you know, as far as complying to the regulations to make them more simultaneous when that's possible. I have no idea if that makes sense or not, but for your particular industry, but I've just seen it, that sort of initiative in other industries. So
that's worth consideration. Thank you.
Thanks. If there aren't any other questions, I'd just say thanks again for being here. You really added to our understanding of this. We're going to try and keep moving since we have a few other people we want to hear from. And your story, I think, will remain even after you are not here. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
For being here. We'll try again now.
We have a tech.
Excellent. We have some assistance
have
to help us get Mr. Murray on the phone.
Let me just make sure I have that. Okay, good.
Excellent.
Yes.
Our fingers crossed.
This is what happened last time.
Yeah, we got to this point.
We got to this point.
Didn't get a ring.
We didn't get a ring before.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Pete Murray.
Hi, Mr. Murray. It's Tobias Reed here. We are in the Capitol in hearing room E. We apologize for the difficulty in connecting with you earlier, but you have the committee here, some folks in the audience, and if you're ready, we would love to hear your story.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much.
And if you wouldn't mind identifying yourself for our record here, too, that'd be great.
Good morning or good afternoon, everybody. My name is Peter Murray. I'm Vice President of Operations for Welch Allyn, and I'm currently located in Beaverton. I appreciate your flexibility in letting me testify remotely. That was a last-minute change, and I'll use the story to help introduce the company. Our company is a medical device provider, and as such, we're regulated by the FDA. And this week, the FDA came into our offices, and unfortunately, I was the designee. I didn't realize until the last minute that I had to sign some of the reports that the FDA were submitting to us just a few moments ago. So that's why I was not able to attend the hearing in person.
We hope the reports are positive.
They are. Yeah. It was. It's the right thing to do. So, thank you very much. Briefly, just to orient you to my testimony, I want to talk a little bit about the experience that this site has had working with OMEP and in pursuing our lean journey. Welch Allyn, just to give you a quick overview, is a privately held company. We were founded in 1918 in Central New York, and I'm sure everyone goes to their doctor and has them stick a, you know, that bright light in their eyes or in their ears, which irritates everybody. We're the inventors of those, and you have a wide range of other medical devices. But that's really how the company got started. It's privately held, closely held, and then still that way. Prior to Welch Allyn acquiring us, we were Protocol Systems. So if anyone's been around a long time in this more Metro Portland area, they would know who we are. The site specializes in making advanced multi-parameter patient monitoring systems. These are essentially electronic devices that capture physiological data, and we also transmit that data to physicians wherever they are. Welch Allyn acquired us to expand their portfolio, obviously, in those markets. So we are the headquarters of Welch Allyn's monitoring division. We have about 400 employees, and again, we're located right in the heart of Beaverton. We about 4 years ago, we knew we needed to make some changes to our competitive position, both from external competitors as well as internal competitive metrics. And we began looking around for some partners to help us, and I was fortunate enough to make Pat Murphy's acquaintance with OMEP, and we began our lean journey with them. And I think everyone has maybe a handout I'm aware of kind of that summarizes our success story, so I won't go over that data with you, but just from what's described on that success story, we've been able to match those results over the last year, I think, because that's about a year old, with some more successes. And through this lean journey working directly with OMEP, we have been able to improve those numbers to just in 08 alone, we increased our savings by another $500,000 in direct expenses. In other words, we had a growing year, but we were able to reduce the cost of operations by $500,000 with consequential savings in inventory and other key metrics. One of the things that's very significant about that was that last year was a pivotal year for our company in terms of our strategic direction, and we are actually consolidating operations further in North America, and we're expanding, but we're trying to concentrate and grow in a few areas. Fortunately, the Oregon site was chosen as one of those sites, principally because of our lean transformation work. So as a result of that, last year our corporation invested about $6 million in infrastructure improvements in the Oregon site, and then we plan to put about another $1 million in this year to generate the infrastructure to produce our next generation of medical devices. So we were very happy about that and very proud. And it retains sales probably about $120 million and allows us to grow sometime this year and partly in the next. We'll probably add another $30 or $40 million to that. As I was talking to Representative Reed a couple weeks ago, our external competition really isn't as fierce as our internal competition, so winning the internal battle really was more important to us than some of the others. A couple other things I want to highlight, and I think it's very important why OMEP and why the funding request. We've worked, and I have in my own career, worked with numerous outside service providers on a wide range of topics. And OMEP is the only organization that I've really come to respect, truly believes in their client success. And that's partly, and not partly, it's their charter, that they're very results-driven. They're measured from external results collected by a third party. They're really not as interested in trying to get the next consulting assignment or growing their consulting revenues. They really are concerned with their client's long-term success. So it's a very beneficial relationship that we've had for several years, and one that we plan to continue for the next couple of years. Another thing that I've come to respect about the organization, I'm on the board, and I've had the opportunity of meeting many of the staff and the leadership of the organization, and it is a first-class organization run by a really dedicated group of professionals, and we're very lucky in this state to have that quality of an organization. I've seen it in our headquarters state, and it's not nearly as effective as it is here in Oregon. I guess the last point I want to make is that there's a natural link between lean and sustainability, and though we're not a leader in this aspect of lean, we have begun this journey this year in 09, and very much look forward to working closely with OMEP to continue to realize this mutual success. I'll take any questions. I was under the impression I had about 10 minutes, so I'm leaving myself a couple of minutes here for questions.
I think you've done very well. I'm looking up and down our dais here to see if there are questions. I feel a little bit unprepared on this since I had a chance to talk to you for an extended period of time, but I see Representative Hovey has raised his hand, so please.
My colleague to the right of me wanted me to ask this question, just in case it's a dumb question. But on your sheet, your success story sheet that you handed out, you use an acronym that's called WIP, and we were sort of trying to figure out what it was, guessing it had something to do with waste, but not really for sure.
It's a very good question, Representative. It refers to a work in process. It's a measure of the inventory that you have to use while you're building your medical device, and reducing that is financially attractive and is a waste
process.
So it's a very good measure in our world of how well you're doing.
Fits very well with the just-in-time model, so that you don't have a lot of partial assemblies sitting in the process.
Right, exactly.
Somewhat of a productivity measure, then.
Yes.
Great. Thank you.
Other questions? No one's looking there. Well, I was really glad to hear about the competitive success you've had. Have you seen that when you talked a little bit about the internal competition, and that makes a lot of sense. Has it proved to be an advantage relative to your external competitors too?
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's the cost savings are directly translated to our customers and allows us to continue to grow. You know, a lot of U.S. companies have moved their operations offshore to lower costs. Well, Challen, I think, is probably in this space the only U.S. Company that has not done that. So we're sort of a contrarian on that front by continuing to produce, the bulk of the value of the product in the U.S. And so, you know, to be able to do that and still get customers that can afford and want to buy your product is sometimes an achievement, but it is what we're doing. We were able to grow our market share last year at the expense of our competitors, and we're looking forward to doing it again this year.
I appreciate hearing that. Representative Thatcher.
Well, thank you. Representative Bent asked a really good question to our last testimony that we just heard. I just wondered if you could tell us if there's anything that we could do from a government standpoint that would help you with your regulatory burden.
Very good question, Representative Thatcher. It's, I'll give you two comments to that question, two answers. One, relative to the other states within the U.S. that we operate in, Oregon is very business friendly, and again, we operate in California, Illinois, and New York. And in particular, in comparison to New York, we look fabulous. And so, I want to congratulate the folks that are part of that, including economic development, because they have really made a difference there. On the regulatory side, the state's impact on our business is not nearly as significant as the federal side. Again, I explained that the feds were here for a week and they got our undivided attention. That's really more what drives our business. And so it's, again, I really don't have much to offer on the state other than praise for the times that we do work, that we get pretty good support, and it makes it very simple for us to navigate through the state. It's more at the federal level that we would probably have a longer answer.
And I'll just reiterate the same answer I gave to our previous witness as well. As you come upon those opportunities, that's part of our interest in the committee, so don't hesitate to let us know.
All right, thank you.
Are there other questions?
I'm just glad we rate higher than New York as far as business.
We're much higher in California, too, which I was always interested to find out.
Yeah.
That's good. Well, we'll continue to be upwardly mobile in our aspirations. If there aren't any other questions, I guess we'll let you get back to your important work interacting with the FDA, and really say thanks again for your willingness to call us and help share the story of your lean journey, and we're glad it's continuing too.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thanks very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay, so we'll shift gears just a little bit and ask Russ Monk to come up and tell us another story. And I don't want to jump his testimony too much, but I've had the chance to visit the High Impact Technologies headquarters, and so my sense is that we'll be hearing a little bit more about innovation in this context. But I think we're in for some entertainment and learning opportunities.
This also is my first time, so thank you.
I'm glad you're here.
I'm Russ Monk, Director of Operations and one of the owners of High Impact Technologies. And we're kind of an unusual story in how we came into existence. If you find, she's handing out the packets. Well, this triangle-shaped document, that'd be the best place to start if you look through your folder. There were three different companies working intimately together on different projects, and we invented a technology that's being used in Iraq on fuel tankers for self-healing of fuel tanks. And it'll probably be easier just to explain the technology by handing it over. And the bullet, that's a 50 cal bullet hole coming through the tan side. And what happened is the fuel tankers were being shot up in Iraq. The fuel was bleeding out, catching fire, stopping the missions, putting soldiers in harm's way. And so this technology was a very, very big problem. Late of 04, the Army sent out an emergency request, how can we solve this problem? The conventional tactic at that point was steel armor or something of that vintage. We looked at it and said, the hole is the problem, it's leaking. If you put steel armor on it, you're going to drop about half the fuel off the tanker because of the weight. And by just, you know, making it much lighter, let's just stop the hole. It went from a raw idea to military approval in 10 days. And it was approved for use in a war zone. At the 11th day, we shipped up a whole team that shipped off to theater, and we actually ported the entire technology, drums of resin, all the technicians to theater, and actually started spraying the vehicles there. The sustainability part of this, that's part of the innovation of this, but if you can keep the fuel in the tank, pipelines, rail yards, infrastructure that has liquids that are hazardous, chemicals like chlorine, things like that, you know, now what you have is a protective coating that would just prevent leakage like that. So that really became our base product, but we had these three different companies that were working together, and when you're working with this mass of a project with that kind of momentum on it, you end up, you know, who's on first, I don't know who's on second going on. So we created a company called High Impact Technologies, and we basically bootstrapped all three companies, and if you look at the model, you can kind of see what we do in the middle there. And that company became kind of a technology development company, and it became one voice with the military. So now you just have one set of conversations going on, one set of to-do lists like that. We made the conscious choice because we had these other companies that are functioning day-to-day, doing, you know, arm's-length transaction with each other. We made the choice to take the dollars that High Impact Technologies would earn and roll it back into new technology, new product development, and jobs. And so if you look a little further, there's a chart that has three rectangles like that. That became our business model. Phase one, phase two, phase three. And what we looked at is phase one is the technology development, and we really take the time to create the technology to a production-ready state, and you look at green techniques, green technologies, sustainable jobs, sustainable people. You know, that was the focus of that key technology. The second major phase is the hard manufacturing. Okay, we don't want to be the hard manufacturers. We want to actually create the technologies, but we want to go into a Coos County or a Jackson County and say, where do you need jobs? Where can we bring the technology, stand it up into your production facility, even if it's a company that's been mothballed or a company that's running at 20% of capacity, complement their production and bring the jobs up through that sustainability hub. And then the third key phase is the sales and marketing side. All three phases of this have different sets of brain cells, different sets of motivators, and different sets of people that do well in each of these. So we made the conscious choice as a company to step back, be the technology development company, and take the time to create the jobs, create the green technologies that these jobs can become. And so that's why I think Representative Reed asked me to come and speak to that. I would like to just talk about some of the other technologies, if that would be okay.
Please.
And then if you look through the file, there's a boat. There's four pictures of a boat. Looks like that one. Mm-hmm. That is actually a pontoon shape that we water jet in one of our plants that is actually recycled foam. And what you do is you take that shape, the holes that are in it, you actually have like pool noodles, and you start locking all these pieces together, create the shape, and then our special coating that we created that's used on the military tankers, we actually spray over that whole thing, and it becomes a boat, a non-deflatable inflatable, in essence, is what it is. And you could puncture that 100 times and it would never sink. So this is in the rollout stage using a green technology. We're the specifiers on it. We're the technology development side of it. And we actually are taking, and we're going to port this into a couple of manufacturers around the state to actually build these boats with their name or our name on it. It depends on how it goes. So that's kind of a fun technology that way. If you see the picture, there's six of us standing on one edge of the boat in the water. That was 1,400 pounds on one edge. Another technology that is in the early stages, and I'll come this way this time to be nice. Thank you. This is a composite rebar. And your classic rebar rusts, even if it's epoxy coated or special painted, a technician pulling a piece of rebar, rubbing it on it, the painting gets rubbed off. And what happens at that point is the rust migrates into even a small pinhole, starts from the inside and starts working out. A good example of that is on the Empire State Building, they had 1-inch bolts that had 12 inches of rust on the outside of the bolt. In Canada, they only allow stainless steel or composite rebar in their bridges. And what happens is the sustainable part of this technology is you put a bridge in, it lasts for 150 years. It doesn't degrade. You don't have the failure mode is the steel rusting, the rib cage rusting out. And this is a technology that we acquired out of Lima, Ohio, that we're actually standing up here in the next 2 months. And there's 4 billion feet of rebar used in the United States. We're looking to get 2% of that. It's about 80 million linear feet. That would take 2 plants here in Oregon to make that much rebar. Okay, so that's our goal that way. We own all the patents, and we acquired all the equipment and all the techniques at that point. So this is a green technology on two ways. One, it's concrete is the number one emitter industry worldwide of carbon footprint. You wouldn't think concrete is, but it is the number one, period. This is a green technology, and it makes your concrete last longer. So, and it's lighter, so you don't have to use as much concrete, and there's a couple different things like that. So the pilot plant's going to be here in Salem, and then we're working with a couple different manufacturers around the state to bring manufacturing plants up. We don't want to own the manufacturing. That's really kind of our twist in this. But and working with the state economic development team, we're going to the different guys and saying, who needs the work? What county can we plug this into? What can we do to help bring the jobs back in? So that's another one of our technologies. And if there's any questions, please jump in.
I think we're all fascinated by it. Just wondering what's coming next.
I'll start with the middle.
Well, I've worked with, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I worked with rebar a lot in my life, and it's a lot lighter, so it probably has some good OSHA implications. But as far as having it make the concrete last longer, it's my understanding that concrete just essentially starts deteriorating after about 80 years, the concrete itself. But I recognize that the failure of rebar inside concrete has been a long issue.
Correct.
but
there's new concretes that are coming out that have a lot higher, longer life.
Right.
The chemistry's really been escalated in the last 10 years.
Yeah, they moved away from cement and going to additives more.
Correct.
So I'm just curious what this is made out of.
Fiberglass. You know, think of your classic fiberglass. It's 70% fiber and 30% resin. And it's actually an extruded mechanism, and it goes through an oven to cure it.
And it has the same strength as...
It's one quarter the weight of classic steel, and it's the same strength.
Same strength, wow.
Yeah. Part of the reason that we picked up the mothballed plant is it was created about 15 years ago. Ash tow and a number of the regulatory, you know, the ability to use it in bridges, the ability to use it, you know, legally in construction, was really, they're the most conservative group on the planet. And so what they basically have waited for in the last 6 months, that ash tow spec has finally been let, and this is the number one rebar that was used in the ash tow spec.
Mm.
So, and the plant will be, the pilot plant will be 6 minutes from here. Yeah. The new piece that's floating around that way, it's a recycled foam in the middle. It's the same foam plastic that makes Pepsi bottles. It's PET is the name of the foam. And the fiberglass faces, it's a fiberglass that actually has, as they're making the fibers, they're melting a resin around the fibers. And you use heat and pressure, and you can shape three-dimensional panels with this. And it just put it, kind of sandwich it in raw form. And the heat and pressure then locks the shape up. And now what you can do is make plywood-esque panels. It's about half the weight of plywood, and it's about as strong physically as plywood. But the green part of this and the sustainable part of this is I can take a plywood plant that's mothballed or that's running at partial capacity, use the same equipment, same people, same forklifts, and be able to bring that work in to create a new green technology that won't ever rot or won't ever absorb water. And it's shapeable. We really can't shape plywood. You can shape this to three-dimensional parts. So I wanted to, you know, start on the technology side of some of the things that we're working on and developing. We grew 70% last year, and I'm very proud of that. You know, there's a lot of our partners in the game that aren't. And we have a couple of big projects coming online this year that will grow us about another 50% that we know right now. And really what our key function on this is we start at the innovation side of the game, and we're the specifiers, the designers, and we can actually bring the different companies or the different technologies into the game and actually make the conscious choices. What's green? What's sustainable? Is this intelligent? And then be able to take that technology and put it anywhere in the state. And the entire program has to be portable.
I think you win the prize for the most volume and interesting things you brought with us, and I imagine we're going to have some questions for you. So Representative Galizio has one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Monk, thank you for taking the time out today.
Gladly.
First, a short question that Representative Gilliam wanted to know. Where is your headquarters located?
Tigard, Oregon.
Tigard, Oregon. Okay,
yep.
Thank you very much.
Yep.
And then the follow-up was, I had the pleasure, as I know you did as well, Mr. Chair, of visiting high-impact technology, and Mr. Monk was kind enough to take me around, and he was extraordinarily energetic, and I walked by a wall full of patents and patents pending, and it was very exciting, and it's the classic example of sort of a company that's doing well by doing good. You, at that time, in the news a lot more, you were hearing about these IEDs or improvised explosive devices in the war in Iraq. And we were talking quite a bit about that. I know you sort of mentioned that before, but I'd be interested if you could just explain a little bit about how your work has been saving people's lives.
Gladly. Thank you, Representative. The first thing is the self-healing coating. In the theater of operations, the tankers were being shot up, the fuel was bleeding out, and the insurgents were shooting incendiary rounds into the equation and catching the tankers on fire. So, you know, bad day anyway. The other thing is roadside bombs were hitting the tankers. The chunks were puncturing the tank, but it wasn't leaking any of the fuel out. So, you know, it's much easier to mitigate an event that doesn't happen. That's our basic philosophy like that. And so that part of the game is definitely part of it. If you look again at the companies that are part of this, the bottom corner down here is Oregon Ballistics Lab and Composite Materials Research and Development. It's one of five, Oregon Ballistics Labs is one of five certified ballistics labs that can do body armor in America. And it's, again, it's only a couple minutes from where we're sitting. The State Department comes in and actually tests one of two labs in the whole country that allows them to test force entry door systems. Think of a mob that's trying to rush an embassy or burn down the embassy or something like that. And so we actually have to develop technologies that defeat this, and then we have the certification to test it as well. We have armor that's sitting in Afghanistan on Humvees right now, and we're a subcontractor of about eight different programs that are intimate to what's happening in Iraq and in Afghanistan. The fiberglass sheet piece that's right there is actually the substrate of a blast-worthy seat that's used in the MRAP program and in some of the Bradley fighting vehicles and things like that. So we've actually commercialized these technologies, and that's part of our innovation. It's not just a lab rat. It's not just a garage invention. It's how do you take it into a commercial product.
So. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Very impressive, and since we want to replicate you or copy you or clone you 50 or 60 times, we will ask you, I will ask you, if you would take everything you've done, give us the most important thing that you think we could gain from what you've done, and then we'll try to repeat it. What's the thing that made this such a success?
Everybody asks, you know, do you think outside of the box? And I always answer, there's a box. You know, that's part of our thinking that way. Truly, the ability to network with many companies. I'm a capabilities nut, and so mapping out the companies and country in our state that, and finding out what their capabilities are, and then the ability to weave those capabilities into the needed product. Our model is we take on a problem. We're not married to any one technology. We're married to the solution. And so we'll dissect the problem by function, and there's a machining company over here that can take this part of it. There's a coating company over here that has special formulations or a good chemist that we can borrow to bring the formulation in. The ability to interface back and forth between the companies is and trust each other. That's probably the biggest thing. It's the ability to take all those capabilities. The sum is greater than the total of the component parts at that point. One of the companies in the triangle of companies we work with has a $400,000 fabric cutting piece of equipment that was running at about 30% of production. We brought projects in, cutting Kevlar and things like that. Their entire swing shift, I just ate up a swing shift, same overhead, fixed overhead, they just become a whole bunch more profitable by doing it that way. So I think the spark is the ability to lay a project on the table and say, who does what best? And then if you don't know who does what best, we have to invent some of that sometimes. And then also reaching into like the Tom Foxes of the world, the economic development group, and say, hey, I have a need here. Talk to your other 10 or 12 people around the state who has this capability that we could plug in and bring this to them. You know, I think part of the magic in this is that we don't want to be the key manufacturer on it. We want to pull from all these manufacturers. I think that's really the spark that is that. And if this works, it's a rising tide. It's just all of the, everybody does better business because of it.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can't let this go. I think your presentation was a hit. Just waiting for somebody to make that pun.
The company started on
the
pun, can't
believe. It's a fascinating company, and this network that you describe is a very interesting network, and it's a continuation of Representative Bentz's comments and questions about how we can foster greater innovation and a continuation of this network. My question is a little bit more general, where are you seeing constraints to future growth? Do you have the workforce that you need? Do you have the research and development capabilities that you need, the university system to support the R&D that you're doing, supply chain? What are some of those key barriers around there that you're seeing, and how can public policy help?
What a beautiful segue into my win-win page. The first thing I look at
to answer that question, Representative Bailey, is very, very basic. Jobs are the great equalizer. Okay, that's how I look at it. Everybody that's adding to the pile with a job contributes to the game. Everybody that doesn't have a job is pulling in some form from the game. Okay, so what I look at is, at the highest level, is what are the jobs that, can be derived from these technologies, okay? I talked about mapping capabilities a little bit, but the thing that was most compelling learning in working with the economic development group, there's state funds, there's federal funds, there's county funds, there's city funds. In the federal government, there's like 8 different pots of money depending on which program it comes through. I have no idea how to navigate that. And so the ability to have a focal point that can say, here's a need, here's a funding requirement that could come in this way. We're going to stand up the boat project in another company, and we don't need the dollars because we've taken the money all the way up. We've spent the money to create the innovation, to create the technology, to get it to a production-ready state. But the company that's going to manufacture it might need money to put in equipment or training and things like that. So I look at the ability to navigate in the different things to bring the different pots of money into play so that you can truly focus the energy that way. By doing that, I look at it as an accelerator. It's, you know, we're going down this path. Just how does it, you know, help push it that way? The other thing that I want to just kind of divest just a hint this way, but I put a 1,000 job case study on the list there. A Freightliner of the world, a Microsoft of the world, there's not that many of them in the world. Oregon's true innovation is the medium to medium small company. And when you bring a big company into play like that, there's huge tax concessions, there's huge infrastructure, things like that. When you're bringing smaller companies into play, it's a much quicker bar. The Sanyo plant coming into Salem, 2.5 years of negotiation, you know, many, many thousands of hours of you know, wrangling the negotiation, things like that. So the ability to take small companies and energize them is how I would weave that back into the story at this point. And again, mapping their capabilities is the other part of that. The Army took, they realized their procurement system was way, way, way too, just massively ineffective. And when you have people dying in a battlefield, they put a whole new division called the Rapid Equipment Force in. And their idea is to take a desperate need, take a solution to it, and in 3 months bring that solution together and solve the problem. And it basically created its own avenue. If it grew to a major program, then it would go through the classic environment like that. And I think a mapping of Oregon like that might be an interesting concept to throw into here to help do that. The other thing is, most of your true innovations and your innovators are not good business people or are challenged in the business part of the game. Say that politically correct, I guess.
I think we got it.
Yeah. And the ability to have somebody come in and say, what are you really trying to do? What are the dollars you really need? How do you walk that through to push it into there? And so I would look at how to be able to bridge that. A lot of your true innovation, a lot of your new jobs, in my mind, for our great state is going to come from the groundswell of that. The other place I really think our jobs are going to come from is when your capabilities map the state. I have some parts that are being machined in Wisconsin. Is there somebody in Oregon that could do that and try to draw some of that cross-pollinating of the jobs back into play? Yeah, and I look at if we're pulling in from jobs like that, that is a sustainable scenario in my mind. Yeah. The business triangle that I put on the page, the Carolinas did a phenomenal job of creating a balance between government, business, and education. They focused all three of them about 25 years ago, and it became a juggernaut. Freightliner moved to the Carolinas, you know, and it's part of that, candidly. That triangle and the ability to take what education requirements are needed to balance the industry side of the game to help business push on, you know, that was a really brilliant stroke, whoever, you know, whatever team could see that, candidly. I would love to see our state look at something like that and focus that three-legged stool to that effect.
That's great. I really wish we had lots more time to hear your story. We're running out of time. I did see Representative Thatcher had your hand up. If you had a question, we could...
Yes, fortunately, he did ask one of them, but I did have a question. I was kind of fascinated with this. I see it called C-bar instead of
composite rebar.
Obviously, the Oregon Department of Transportation utilizes reinforced concrete structures
Correct.
To a large extent. Have you worked with them on getting this project approved?
We are just starting that conversation. Without the certification in hand, they really have their hands tied, and so that's only come down recently now, and that conversation can ensue. It goes two ways, new construction of bridges and also retrofitting of old infrastructure. You can drill gouge grooves in the bottom of an old bridge and actually put rebar and other structure material underneath it and keep the bridge from collapsing by doing that. And there's a number of bridges in Oregon that actually have that. So the Department of Transportation is definitely a complement to this.
I hate being the guy to have to try and sort of compile our thanks. I think everybody really enjoyed what you had to say.
Thank you.
Your show and tell was great. I hope we'll be able to have you back sometime. I think you've given us a really good model, particularly as you described the intersection of business, education, and government as a place we might aim for the state. So thanks for helping orient us, and hopefully we'll have you back again soon.
My pleasure, sir.
Thank you very much. And I think it's a nice, perhaps a little bit of a reverse order than one might expect, but as we've heard sort of at a little bit more of a micro level, some of the stories in the first person, we now have a chance to hear a little bit more of a theoretical kind of construct from Ed Whitelaw and Bryce Ward, if they'd like to come forward. Ask them to kind of help us contribute to that orientation about why this question really matters to Oregon, what are some of the opportunities that are in front of us, and where we can go. So thanks for being here. Thanks for your patience, and hopefully you got some out of the stories that
actually
came
quite
before
a bit.
Us,
I would great. Rather have listened than had to speak now. So that last one I really liked. So
and if you wouldn't mind introducing yourself, to
indeed.
Start, that'd be great. Thank you.
My name is Ed Whitelaw. I'm at the University of Oregon in the Economics Department. I'm the head of an economic and financial and planning consulting firm. I look at Representative Bailey because he is in the firm I head. We've been in business since 74. I've been at the university since 67. And I'm going to come back to that point at the end of our part. Bryce Ward, well, go ahead.
I'm Bryce Ward. I'm a senior economist at Echo Northwest.
Well, actually, yeah, just he is a fourth generation graduate of Grants Pass High School. So I've been here, 42 years?
I've only been here 32, but I've only been alive that long.
So let me, if that is enough,
yes.
It's enough for me. We haven't done this yet, the handouts, right? Okay, let me do the. Do you have one?
I have one.
Yeah, okay. So, you mentioned theoretical.
Perhaps I said the wrong the wrong description, but to get us
right.
started.
So, what I'm going to try to do, and you'll see this coming out, there are three parts to this play, and we're actually only going to address the first part. So let me tell you what we plan to do, and then we'll try to do that. And then I will come back and comment on sort of collective memory. So does everybody have a handout? Okay, so this is a retro PowerPoint, which I generally prefer. Representative Reed posed a statement when I asked him, so what exactly... Actually, to just a little more background, one of the other principals in the firm is a guy named Terry Moore, who is a planner. We were planning to participate. He and I were going to do this. Then our schedule started moving around. So imagine that Terry is here and would have presented a planner's perspective. So that's the content of it, but I also want to clarify then what we're doing. We're going to try to help you look through our economist's eyes at the statement Representative Reed, you posed, namely, how can we have economic growth and support the environment? Is that close? Okay. Good so, place to start. And of course, then getting into that, one gets into a notion of sustainability. So here's what we're going to do, and this is maybe the drier. You remember in school when some pointy-headed intellectual would lay out some assumptions and definitions, and you'd sit there and think, what is this about?
We're back in class.
Indeed. but I will try to get through it quickly and as painlessly as possible. So there's a Roman numeral 1 having to do with economic terms and concepts. Think of this as calisthenics in discussing economic growth as economists talk about it, the environment as economists talk about it, and sustainability. There are Roman numerals 2 and 3, and it's not just because of the time, but because of your willingness to endure this, that we will stop at the end of Roman numeral 1. I put this other stuff in here in case there are any questions. We're trying to anticipate what questions you might ask, and of course we'll blow it, but there's some opportunities to make it more practical and bring it home to Oregon. So, having said all that, let's focus with me. Roman numeral 1, we're going to talk about economic terms and concepts. I'm going to do uppercase A, terms and concepts that you think are relevant here, at least from these economists' perspective, and then Bryce will go after sustainability. So, I apologize for what appears to be very elementary. It's not meant to be condescending, but I want to build some language in common, which we don't have yet, and then try to build that to talk about these issues that Representative Reed posed. So I begin with this notion of, so if we're talking about economics, then what's the economic problem that economics tries to solve? And the basic one is, and those of you who have endured introductory economics can remember some definition to the effect, well, economics is really about allocating scarce resources among competing demands. So then what are these resources? And all I'm doing here is building blocks so that we can talk about economic growth a little bit and Bryce can talk about sustainability. If these resources that we deal with, all sorts of resources, labor, minerals, and salt water, and so on. If none of them were scarce, then Bryce and I would be out of a job. That is, there would be no economic problem. And so, so when economists talk about resources, and again, I'm building blocks here for the discussion of sustainability. When they talk about what are these resources that we're talking about, there are usually four basic forms of resources or capital. And in economics, capital refers to things, not sort of financial capital or, you know, a dollar here, a dollar there. Rather, there are four basic types. One of them we're all familiar with is the physical capital, human-made physical capital. Air, roads and bridges and so on. You hear a lot of that with the stimulus package. But also buildings in which we operate or Mr. Monk's firm operates in. Those are all pieces of capital. They are things that last for a long time. Another category of capital that is integral to any economic operation is what economists call human capital, education, training. So it's labor, and it's not just bodies, it's sort of enhanced bodies through education and training and the like. A third category is social capital. I'm going to turn that to Bryce. He, after undergraduate at the U of O, he went to Harvard, got his doctorate, and one of his specialties was and remains social capital.
Broadly, social capital refers to the productive aspect of our social life. You don't think about it, but your friendships have value. Your networks have value. They provide you information. They provide you access to favors. Ultimately, they create norms of behavior that we use to govern everyday life. If I were to get up and introduce myself to you, I would shake your hand. That's a norm that I've learned as part of my social upbringing, and that has conveys certain respect and other, you know, other intangibles that ultimately help us be productive. At the aggregate level, this ultimately starts to look something like trust and reputation. Without trust, the economy particularly can start to break down. And some are, you know, have discussed how part of what's going on with our financial markets currently is a breakdown in trust. People can't just look at a bank and say, oh, sure, I can give you my money and you will lend it productively because I don't know if you're going to be in business tomorrow. So that's ultimately kind of a two-second summary of what social capital.
Well, and captures. Mr. Monk again referred to that the whole notion of networks, that a term that we've all used for a long time, that is social capital. You break those networks down, you let them disintegrate, you've lost a major resource on which economies are built.
Yeah, just to put it in Mr. Monk's context, he talked about he doesn't produce the stuff. He has to look outside. He has an idea and he looks for something else. And the information that allows him to find the person that to match him with that thing, that's the social capital in our system.
So then the fourth is natural capital. Forested mountains, clean streams, mineral ores, all of that stuff is the natural capital. And no one of these is sufficient to pull off an economic operation. Each is necessary, and it's only when you get the group working that you can prosper. So, again, these are sort of little building. I trust they aren't short pieces of string that we won't be able to weave into something coherent. But, okay, so there's these four pieces of capital, these types of capital. In your statement, you use the term economic growth. In the title of your committee is the term economic development. In economics, those have quite distinct meanings. So I'm just going to just run through, again, some calisthenics on what we're talking about. With economic growth, that's the EG there, in economics, it's typically a long-run concept. And for economists, the long run, almost all the forecasts we get at the beginning of the year, and each of us is on forecasting panels, and we talk about that, and what's going to happen to interest rates, and what about housing starts, and so on. Those are all short-term concepts. Almost all the forecasts we encounter are 4 quarters, maybe 6 quarters at the most. Long run kicks in 5 years out, 10 years out, you can be talking about 20, 30, 40, 50 years out. And so when we talk about long run in economics, we're typically talking about increasing sort of our standard of living or our well-offness or something along that line, a proxy for which is typically something like per capita income. And we usually think of it as, you know, our paychecks and so on. I want to just focus on that briefly because in economics, we typically go beyond that first paycheck that's denominated in dollars, and we also include the second one that is denominated in all sorts of things. Low probability of getting mugged. A pristine beach that's publicly owned on the Oregon coast. All of those are part of this standard of living. And then another insight has to do with economic growth. It has having to do with building the capacity to have economic activity. That is to say, building those four forms of capital and maintaining them so that they are productive over time. And I say those to contrast it with notions of economic development that, in a sense, speak to the utilization of the capacity that we're building with our four forms of capital. And I mean, yeah, that's a lot of jargon in it, but we'll try to bring it home to something useful. Typically, when people are talking about economic development, they're talking about the number of jobs, the number of people in employment, the number of shoes sold. These are aggregate measures, in a sense. And however many bodies you've got, if the standards of living of all of them is very low, getting more of them, it's hard to think about that as a positive thing. Okay? And so that's another insight into this discussion. And finally, there's a notion of comparative advantage. And these definitions and so on, you can go to Wikipedia, you can go to Wikidictionary, you can go to any number of sources and get variations on these definitions. I had a bunch of URLs and so on in here and finally just trashed them because it's easy enough to go and get this stuff directly. But this notion of comparative advantage is going to be important when when we try to put sustainability into the picture. Comparative advantage, intuitively, it's just sort of, I can do it better than you can. That is, if I have a this isn't strictly true, but I'm cheating a little, but intuitively it's, okay, you and I might be on a team together, and I don't care what the sport is, as long as it's a team sport, and you might be able to do each, whether you're a fullback or a center or a guard or whatever, you might be able athletically to play every one of those roles better than anybody on the team, and yet
it's unlikely. But
okay, right. So suspend your disbelief momentarily.
Thank you.
And so, but on the team, we would ask you to specialize in what you do best among the things you do. It's that kind of notion. The reason that's going to be important is among the comparative advantages Oregon has, the singular one is its natural capital. And that's why, back to how can we have economic growth and support the environment? A short answer, bumper sticker answer is, if you don't support the environment, it's going to be a hell of a lot more difficult to have economic growth. It's not that you can't have it, it's just it's much more difficult. So having said that,
now we can talk about sustainability. Sustainability, I'm going to start by quoting Nobel Prize winning economist out of MIT, Robert Solow, who has a very classic, I guess it was a speech on sustainability. So Solow says, some people say they don't know what sustainability means, but it sounds good. And a lot of times, sustainability just becomes a word that we attach to anything that we think might be good. He goes on to say that it's very hard to be against sustainability. In fact, the less you know about it, the better it sounds. So my role here is to try and move you beyond just attaching it to anything that sounds good and let's try and make it into some sort of a useful concept that you can actually use to try and help think about decisions that you may need to make. So broadly speaking, sustainability refers to some notion of leaving future generations at least as well off as we are. Perhaps not in we don't have to measure how well they offer, but we at least need to leave them the capacity to be at least as well off as we are, right? So that's kind of the goal when, if you're thinking about, is this sustainable, the question you're essentially asking is an intertemporal one. You know, when I make this decision and am I consuming something that it's going to not be then available to people in future generations, which will make it so that they can't be as well off as we are. So this is an odd discussion because, of course, right now we live at the pinnacle of human civilization. We're much better off than my ancestors who came here 110 years ago, by almost any metric that one might imagine. And, you know, they were, of course, better off than the people who lived 500 or 1,000 years before them. So why are we need to be worried about future generations? Doesn't everything just go up in perpetuity and thus we can consume what we want and they'll be better off? The general problem is that we're starting to butt up against a constraint. You know, we're starting to see a little bit more, be a little bit more concerned about scarcity with respect to our natural capital, right? As we consume and consume and consume, our consumption extracts resources out of the environment, some of which aren't renewable, and ends up putting pollution out into the environment, and the environment is only capable of absorbing so much of that before it starts to push back. So that move to scarcity with respect to natural capital is why we've started, sustainability has become a buzzword in recent decades. So what is sustainability? How do we really think about it in terms of, well, how do we make the future generations no worse off than we are? There's three different concepts that people throw out, and, you know, one doesn't need to subscribe to any particular one of them.
I'm a prop with this for what he's about to say. So
you've rehearsed. This is impressive.
All right. So the first way of thinking about sustainability is what economists use in our little jargon speak as non-declining well-being. So that assumes that essentially we can deplete natural capital as long as we replace it with other forms of capital, right? So we can go and extract all the oil out of the earth, but as long as we you know, build hospitals or figure out how to cure cancer. If we don't leave future generations any oil, but we've left them with something else that allows them to be happy, then we're okay. Right, so it essentially assumes that there's a lot of substitutability between those different forms of capital that Ed outlined previously. So that's one view. Others say, no. We can't just get rid of all of the natural capital. We can't replace, you know, all of these the natural functions with physical capital, social capital, and human capital. We've got to keep natural capital around because natural capital isn't substitutable with these other forms of capital. But as long as we keep the total value of natural capital constant, we can essentially substitute, you know, owls for trees. So, you know, we can get rid of some owls, but if we leave them some more trees, you know, things will work out, we'll be okay. So slightly more restrictive than the first. Now moving down into the third view, this is the most restrictive view, the non-declining ecosystem services. That's very restrictive. This is, look, we have to actually keep the flows that we get from different pieces of natural capital constant. If we deplete any species, if we get rid of, a river or a stream, then we've harmed the future generation because they don't have that service, that those ecosystem services available to them. And ultimately, the assumption underlying this particular view is that our economy, every piece of our economy is and our society is actually intrinsically wound up to natural society. So when you start putting stresses onto natural society, if you break it down, our natural capital, if you break it down sufficiently, it could tip and fall all apart, and all of our other forms of capital are useless if we don't have, you know, an environment that will support it. Right? So those are the three different perspectives that, if you sat in my class in environmental economics, we would spend weeks debating. But I gave you the 10-minute version. You know, which do you really, which do you think is the right way to think about it? But ultimately, sustainability comes back to, well, how much substitutability is there amongst competing forms of capital? And in particular, how much of particular aspects of natural capital do we have to leave to future generations to leave them the capacity to be at least as well off as we are?
Thank you.
Okay, now, just, I want to pose a, it's like a sprint, and I apologize, but I want to just sort of illustrate, this is not meant to be exhaustive, it's meant to be illustrative, as economists look in this kind of stuff, so I want to pose a problem you as a committee face. So,
Let me just break in for 1 second to point out we have approximately 10 minutes left. So I'm glad to hear this summation. Then I want to make sure, because this does feel like class. So I want to make sure that the class has a chance to ask you some questions too.
Okay.
Before we have to
vacate
the room. Thanks.
All I'm going to say is two things. One, first, the problem I think you face. Let me back up. When Goldschmidt was governor, he appointed me to the economic. Well, he asked me if I'd serve on the Economic Development Commission. I said no. Industrial development revenue bonds bore me. Other people can do that. He said, no, I want you to serve as the policy parent for our economic strategy. Before that, and I can remember, some of you may remember the name Ron Ekus or Patricia McKeag or Carrie Barnett and so on when we were much younger and, of course, more rash. In the 80s, we kept thinking, you know, one of the difficulties the legislature has is it has a very short memory. So long-term strategic planning is very difficult because even as you're stuck in the minutiae of some bill or some complaint or whatever, back then, and to a certain extent now, you had difficulty looking back over your shoulder to see the marquee that says, and remember, this is what you're really about in the long run. You guys have, maybe 2005? Is that, did I read the bios correctly? Is that the earliest of any of you? 2000, is anybody 2004 in the legislature? You are, Paul?
Representative Holby, the dean of our committee.
Yes.
It's the Robert Byrd. Okay. Don't become American. Okay, well, in any event, it's hard to have that kind of collective memory if you're talking about long-run strategies, if you're on this biennial cycle or even, you know, whatever the sixth version is, cycle. It's hard to do that. You have a partial answer or a partial solution to the problem, and it's the Oregon Progress Board. That came out of this effort back in 89 with Goldschmidt and others to say, is there a way to sort of try to keep track of things over time? if we want to get into that, that's fine. I just wanted to illustrate that part. And
thank you.
The fourth category of capital, when Bryce is talking about this notion of sustainability, the new Carissa case, I testified for the state on the new Carissa case. I think all of you know that. Does anybody not? You know, when it ran aground and there was a dispute, the governor said, get your trash off the beach, the Rusting Hulk, and the maritime insurers and the new Carissa shipping company both said, well, no, it's actually more expensive to remove it than to leave it there, and under Oregon's trespass law, that would qualify as leaving it there. That would be okay to leave it there. But one of the issues that came up, it was quite distinct, and the jury and the judge got it, was what we're really talking about is this fourth form of capital. Oregonians perceive the Oregon coast as a sort of a natural icon, as it does the gorge, as it does Crater Lake, and so on. And those would fall in the category of you don't diminish those. Those are sort of solid things that you want to keep for a while. And you can talk about substitutability of other things, just as, for example, the debate that the state faces now with what to do with the proposed destination resorts in the Vitolias Basin. We don't have any there now. And Jefferson County, I think, is without destination resorts. What do we want to do about it? Is that true? I'm trying to remember. In any event, the basin, I know, it has no big destination resorts. The state might decide, and I'm not promoting this, I'm just saying it might decide, no, that falls into this fourth category, and we're going to take the third meaning of sustainability, and we're going to keep it natural in some sense. Final point is, we are not preservationists by any stretch of the imagination. We are marketeers in many ways. We just think that you can tweak and exploit market forces to serve social policy admirably.
That's a great place to stop. Thank you very much. You've helped us get oriented in an entirely different way, and I appreciate it. We have 5 minutes for questions. I wish we had a lot more. I wanted to make sure that people had a chance. Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your indulgence. I don't really have a question. I just want to relate, you know, after finishing this class, that I've learned probably more, or I remember more from this class than the one I took from you in Economics 101 in the early 70s. So, and I don't remember social capital at all in that class.
No, as a matter of fact, it wasn't part of the jargon then.
Oh, God, my memory was really bad.
Yeah.
I was in the back. But
maybe we'll have time for Economics 102 sometime. Any other questions then on this side? Yeah. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, it's always nerve-wracking to worry about asking a stupid question in front of your employer.
I'm impressed you're willing to try.
So I'm gonna ask one that I know is stupid, so that I don't have to worry about it.
Would not point or giggle.
Appreciate it. A lot of what you're talking about here sounds like it depends on the capacity to measure these different kinds of capital, and that measurement capacity is critical to any decision-making process. Can you talk a little bit about how we measure these things in order to make decisions?
Briefly, Terry Moore, whom you work with, and one of the other principals I've referred to, one of his favorite lines is, you get what you measure. Now, one of the challenges, and that's right, but, and I make some points here in the follow-up, I said, avoid getting bogged down in the minutia. You guys can get trapped in just details that you don't need to be. Part of the task with sustainability is to sort of step back and remember this long-run strategy, whatever it is. One of the things we tried to do, and it was very difficult to do with the Progress Board, was to say, what is it we can measure now? And the things we can't measure, and it's reasonable to have things that we want to measure that we don't have measures developed yet because conditions have changed. 30 years ago, it may have been very important to you know, document this particular variable, but today we have a substantially different economy. The composition of our employment has changed markedly over the years. So maybe we measure different things. So part of your task is to say, okay, what can we measure now? Progress Board is an excellent source for a lot of that stuff. That URL we did stick in here. But the other point is, if you can't yet measure it, then part of your responsibility might be to say, it's not going to occur this year, but let's start pushing on the measures so that 5 years from now we might be able to keep track of some key variable that in the past we didn't pay much attention to, but now we should. That kind of thing. And measurement is unequivocally important, but at the same time, maybe I should say and there, and at the same time, it's important to transcend some of those details. That is, you know, you guys, part of your role is you're talking about sustainability and growth, which to an economist is long run. Step back from the details and get a sense of where the state is headed as a whole.
There must be some kind of an agreement among professors in different disciplines. I remember our accounting professor in business school said we only had to remember two things if we saw him at a party sometime in the future: incremental analysis and you get what you measure. So it's a good thing to be reinforced. I'm noting the time here, and speaking only for myself here, I wish we had lots more time for class. Perhaps we can have you come back sometime. Really appreciate you making the trip. I think you've helped us think about these things in a nice way that fits with the stories we heard today.
We look forward
to having you back. And unless there's any comments for the good of the order, I'll note that our Tuesday agenda's out, has some bills. Looking forward to getting to work on those.
Minutia.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll get to the minutia. We'll keep your admonition in mind. And with that, we will adjourn the committee. Thanks very much.